informed. We also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Please support our independent journalism at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar. Thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Biden administration keeps insisting that they care about Palestinian lives. If that was true, they would close the spigot of lethal weapons to Israel instead of circumventing congressional processes to rush them through. I think we need to end the charade that this is just an Israeli war and the U.S. is a, you know, hapless observer. This is a U.S.-Israeli joint operation, and that's what we should call it.
The United States is becoming increasingly isolated as it continues to oppose calls for a Gaza ceasefire while sending more munitions to Israel. We'll speak to investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept. Plus, we look at Israel's war on journalists.
We spent 7 weeks investigating the killing of our colleague, Reuters visuals journalist Issam Abdallah. That investigation determined that an Israeli tank stationed just inside of Israeli territory fired two Israeli-made shells in quick succession at a group of clearly identified journalists in southern Lebanon in an attack that international law experts say could constitute a war crime.
We'll speak to the Reuters bureau chief for Lebanon, who investigated the killing of her colleague, Issam Abdallah. And we'll go to the campus of Haverford College in Pennsylvania to speak with Kinan Abdelhamid, one of the three Palestinian students shot over Thanksgiving weekend in Burlington, Vermont. We'll also speak with a Haverford student organizer who took part in a campus sit-in in support of a Gaza ceasefire. She's the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Palestinian Ministry of Health reports Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed 200 Palestinians in the past 24 hours. Among the dead are at least 20 people killed in overnight air raids on Rafah near the southern border with Egypt, where nearly half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million is sheltering from Israel's unrelenting bombardment. Their misery was compounded Wednesday as the area was hit with heavy rains and cold winds. These are Palestinians forced to live in a tent city in Al-Mawasi in southern Gaza, which Israel's designated as the so-called safe zone.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
I have four children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
The United Nations warns Gaza faces a public health disaster. Lynn Hastings is the UN humanitarian coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territories.
We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet. One toilet available for hundreds of people. You can imagine what the sanitation conditions are like as a result.
The World Health Organization says there have been 360,000 cases of infectious diseases recorded in Gaza's shelters. That includes meningitis, jaundice, chickenpox, lice, scabies, upper respiratory tract infections, and diarrhea, a leading cause of death for young children. The World Food Program says 83% of households in southern Gaza are going hungry. In the north, that figure is 97%. In the occupied West Bank, Israel's military has killed at least 11 Palestinians since Tuesday as it carries out its most intense raid since Hamas's surprise attack on October 7th. On Wednesday, Israeli soldiers raided the Freedom Theater in Jenin, a renowned cultural institution whose mission is to fight for Palestinian justice, equality, and self-determination. Two of the theater's producers, Ahmed Tubasi and Mustafa Shetha, were reportedly taken away by Israeli troops. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron says the United Kingdom will deny visas to Israeli settlers who've committed violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The U.S. recently announced similar visa restrictions. This comes as the Biden administration delayed the planned sale of 27,000 U.S.-made M16 rifles to Israel over concerns they could be used in attacks by West Bank settlers against Palestinians. Israel's far-right national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir ordered police not to arrest Israelis who commit violence in the West Bank, where more than 280 Palestinians, including 64 children, have been killed since October 7th. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has confirmed that Israel used U.S.-supplied white phosphorus in attacks on southern Lebanon. White phosphorus poses a high risk of excruciating burns and lifelong suffering, and its use as an incendiary weapon in civilian areas is a war crime, which under U.S. law should have implications for future military aid to Israel. The Washington Post investigation found white phosphorus attacks left at least four people hospitalized and forced the evacuation of the town of Deraa in southern Lebanon. In Washington, D.C., State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller addressed the reports.
Anytime that we provide items like white phosphorus or really anything to another military, we do it with the expectation that it will be used for legitimate purposes and in full keeping with international humanitarian law and the law of armed conflict. So we're looking into this and looking for additional information.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has urged President Biden to end unconditional assistance to Israel's military, saying the United States is complicit in a mass atrocity in Gaza. In a letter to the White House, Sanders urged Biden to slash his request for U.S. military aid to Israel by more than $10 billion, writing, quote, "Israel's military campaign will be remembered among some of the darkest chapters of our modern history, and it's being done with bombs and equipment produced and provided by the United States and heavily subsidized by American taxpayers," unquote. Bernie Sanders' comments came as the Senate Wednesday approved a record $886 billion military spending bill with bipartisan support. The House is expected to pass the bill as soon as today. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera has obtained a letter signed by 139 staffers at the Homeland Security Department denouncing Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and other top officials' response to Israel's assault. The letter, dated November 22nd, reads, quote, "DHS leadership has seemingly turned a blind eye to the bombing of refugee camps, hospitals, ambulances, and civilians," unquote. Russia launched a barrage of drone attacks on southern Ukraine overnight, wounding at least 11 people, including three children, and damaging port infrastructure in the Odessa region as well as the Danube River close to the Romanian border. The attacks came as Russia's military said Russian air defenses shot down nine Ukrainian drones headed towards Moscow just hours ahead of the start of a year-end news conference held by President Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, Hungary's far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban has arrived at a European Union summit in Brussels, where he's promised to block Ukraine's bid to join the EU, as well as a deal to send an additional $54 billion worth of aid to Ukraine. This comes after the European Commission tried to soften Orban's opposition by releasing more than $11 billion in funding to Hungary it had previously withheld after determining Orban's government failed to uphold the rule of law. In the United States, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case on the abortion pill mifepristone, the most widely used method of abortion in the United States. In August, the Fifth Circuit Court sided with a right-wing Texas judge who argued the FDA improperly eased regulations on the pill to make it more accessible and that it should only be used up to 7 weeks into a pregnancy and only issued in person. The Biden administration said the ruling, quote, "threatens to undermine the FDA's scientific independent judgment and would reimpose outdated restrictions on access to safe and effective abortion medication," unquote. For now, mifepristone remains available through telemedicine, mail delivery, and via pharmacies, pending the Supreme Court's decision, which is expected by the end of June next year.
The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to the felony obstruction statute that's been used by the Justice Department to charge over 300 people in connection with the January 6th Capitol insurrection, including Donald Trump. The court's decision could invalidate convictions against those involved in the insurrection and hamper Special Counsel Jack Smith's case against Trump. Separately, justices are considering the special counsel's request to expedite consideration of Trump's claim of presidential immunity. In related news, CNN's published recordings of former Trump attorney Kenneth Chesbrough revealing Trump was told about the fake elector scheme to keep him in office and informed by lawyer Jim Troupas that he'd lost the state of Wisconsin. The revelations come as part of the interviews with Michigan state prosecutors.
It's clear that Troupas personally told the president there was zero hope for Wisconsin. As part of this message, I think, crafted to try to get him to concede, to just, you know, give up this long shot challenge. There was a conscious effort to deflect him from a sense of any possibility that he could pull out the election.
Kenneth Chesbrough, who's been dubbed the architect of the false electors plot, is cooperating with investigations in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Nevada. In October, he pleaded guilty in Georgia's sweeping election subversion case. House Republicans approved a resolution authorizing an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. Republicans accused Biden of abusing his position to advance his family's business interests. A probe into the allegations has not returned any evidence. Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, ranking member of the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability, said, quote, "Everyone knows that the floundering Biden impeachment probe is designed to give Donald Trump something to say when it's pointed out he's been twice impeached and is a proven fraudster, sexual assailant, and defamer of women, who now faces 91 felony charges in federal and state court," unquote. This comes as Hunter Biden made rare public comments Wednesday. The president's son defied a subpoena from House Republicans and instead spoke to press in front of the Capitol.
"For 6 years, I have been the target of the unrelenting Trump attack machine shouting, 'Where's Hunter?' Well, here's my answer. I am here. Let me state as clearly as I can, my father was not financially involved in my business, not as a practicing lawyer, not as a board member of Burisma, not in my partnership with a Chinese private businessman, not in my investments at home nor abroad, and certainly not as an artist."
Republicans said they would move to hold Hunter Biden in contempt for defying their summons. He says he'll testify publicly, but not privately. And Tesla has recalled software from nearly all of its 2 million vehicles on U.S. roads after regulators found the electric car manufacturer failed to ensure that drivers remain attentive while using autopilot, a system that can drive autonomously. This follows a series of accidents involving self-driving Teslas, some of them fatal. Meanwhile, in Sweden, garbage has begun piling up at Tesla's workshops after a major transport workers union said it would stop collecting waste in support of Swedish mechanics who've been on strike since October to protest the anti-union policies of Tesla and its billionaire CEO, Elon Musk. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International are calling for Israel to be investigated for committing war crimes for targeting journalists. The groups have both called for an official investigation into an October 13th Israeli tank strike that killed Reuters journalist Issam Abdallah while he was reporting in southern Lebanon with a group of six other journalists. One of the journalists who survived the attack, Christina Assi of Agence France-Presse, AFP, had to have her leg amputated. She's still hospitalized. Human Rights Watch said it, quote, found no evidence of a military target near the journalist's location, unquote. Reuters also conducted its own investigation and concluded that Issam Abdallah was killed by an Israeli tank shell. This is an excerpt of a short video report produced by Agence France-Presse. It includes interviews with AFP reporters Christina Assi in her hospital bed and Dylan Collins.
Reuters video journalist Issam Abdallah was killed on Friday, October 13th, when a shell hit him.
Six other journalists are wounded, among them AFP photographer Christina Assi, who suffers serious injuries, later needing an amputation of her right leg.
Everything gets white, and I lose sensation in my legs.
I saw Christina on the ground.
And I immediately ran to her, and we were hit the second time.
Fuck. There was no Hamas around us, no Hezbollah around us.
Seven journalists wearing flak jackets, wearing helmets, everyone with press written on their chest. There's no way they didn't know that we were press.
And we were attacked by Israel twice, not once.
That was AFP reporter Christina Assi, who lost her leg after being hit by an Israeli tank shell October 13th in the same attack that killed Reuters journalist Assam Abdallah. And this is an excerpt from a video made by Amnesty International documenting how it determined that Assam Abdallah was killed by an Israeli tank shell.
In many cases, when we work on conflicts, the weapon can directly lead us to perpetrators. This is the key piece of evidence. My colleague, who is our weapons analyst, knew immediately what this weapon is.
It was a 120 millimeter tank round, and that confirmed that it was the Israeli military that fired on the journalists, because Hezbollah and the armed groups in South Lebanon don't use those kinds of weapons.
And more importantly, we did identify this weapon before being used by the Israeli forces in the context of different strikes on Gaza. So this is at least the third time where we are able to link this type of weapon with the Israeli forces.
An excerpt of a video by Amnesty International. We're joined now by Maya Jubeli. She is the Reuters bureau chief for Lebanon. She co-wrote the new Reuters special report, Israeli Tank Fire Killed Reuters Journalist Assam Abdallah in Lebanon. Maya, welcome to Democracy Now! Our condolences to you and your colleagues on the loss of Assam. If you can talk about what exactly you found, talk about that day, as we just heard these other reporters who survived the attack, one having lost her leg, discuss it.
Thank you, Amy, for having us on. And of course, Assam's loss is one that we continue to feel every single day in the Reuters Bureau and across the media teams across Lebanon. That day, I mean, ironically and very sadly, it was Friday the 13th, and Haizam had been in the south covering Israeli shelling on Lebanese territory for a few days by that point. And he's a very seasoned journalist. So as you have reported yourself as well on this show in the past, Haizam had a lot of conflict experience. He did everything right along with the colleagues with whom he was on that day. They were wearing press helmets. They were wearing vests that had press written on them. They were in an open area in which they could be clearly identified by all of the, obviously, the Israeli drone activity above, the Israeli helicopter activity around them, that they could be clearly identified as press. And that evening, it was really as the sun was setting, that team of journalists, there were seven of them there in total on that hilltop, were hit twice, 37 seconds apart. First by an Israeli tank shell that hit Assam and killed Assam immediately, and 37 seconds later by another tank shell that hit the vehicle that had been driven by the two Al Jazeera journalists that were also going live from that location. And really, it was the experts that we spoke to at the end of our investigation, after presenting them with the evidence that we had gathered, you know, noting that there were two strikes in such quick succession at a team of journalists that could be so clearly identified. That warrants, you know, the calling this a violation of international humanitarian law and possibly amounting to a war crime.
So talk about this. I mean, you've got Al Jazeera, you've got AFP, Agence France-Presse, you've got Reuters. Assam had just set up, what, like an hour before, this live feed that people all over the world were watching. I talked to another Reuters journalist. He said he was watching and suddenly just this strike, trying to figure out what had taken place. So in a sense, he actually filmed his own death, Aissa.
Yes, and I think that is the ultimate kind of, you know, he was really bearing witness to everything that was happening in southern Lebanon. And Assam himself is from southern Lebanon, and so you know, it is such a testament to the power of his work and of his job that really it was him and the feeds of other journalists that were there in the area that provided such an important piece of evidence for us as we were investigating exactly what happened. I mean, in the immediate aftermath, you know, we were gathering the footage from different journalists who were there. We were also gathering what Isam had filmed himself on his camera and on his phone. And it was so difficult to go through that evidence, knowing that he had really documented such important evidence of what had taken place that day.
And can you talk about the tank shell, the two tank shells that injured and killed the journalists, and how you were able to identify them? We just heard clips from Amnesty and AFP, and how precise they were, as opposed to a dumb bomb that's being used, for example, in Gaza in almost half the cases.
Absolutely. So what we did in the immediate aftermath, the attack was on a Friday. By Sunday, we were trying to gain access to the site where Isam was killed. There was ongoing shelling in the area, so it was very difficult for us to be able to go and to collect evidence. But we were able to get to the site and to spend a few minutes there, essentially just picking up what we thought could be shrapnel so that we could get it tested. We later on then also obtained another, kind of the tail fin, which is the biggest piece of evidence that we had. And these were taken to a lab in The Hague. We had other analysts looking at them at the same time visually and being able to kind of identify the features of these different bits of shrapnel visually to tell us what they think it might be. The lab was able to test them from a chemical perspective to test, you know, what chemical components were there. And these independent analytical processes came to the same conclusion, which is that this is an Israeli-made tank, as you noted in the introduction as well. It's made by an Israeli weapons manufacturer, and it is fired from a weapon system that's on top of a Merkava tank. And so that was really the conclusive kind of evidence, in addition to a geolocation of the exact firing location from where these shells were fired, that could allow us to conclusively say that this was an Israeli tank using an Israeli weapon system, fired from an Israeli location that hit those journalists on that day.
And what about the drones? One of the things the reporters describe, well, they say there wasn't gunfire. They weren't like caught in the crossfire at that point. It was quiet. That there were drones. They were all wearing their press gear. You know, you could see P-R-E-S-S. They said, I'm sure that they could see their faces that closely. Talk about the level of Israeli surveillance there.
It's a really important point, and not one that should be overlooked. Again, these journalists did everything right. In the interviews that we conducted as well with our own teams that were there, Thaer al-Sudani, Reuters photographer, Maher Nazih, Reuters video journalist, who were also wounded on that day, they said, we chose that location specifically, not just because we had a clear view of the border area, which we wanted to be filming, but also because there were different positions along the border that had a clear view of us. And so nobody could then accuse us of embedding with armed groups, doing something suspicious, you know, hiding behind a line of trees, anything like that. We were clearly visible from all sides. And that was one of the key reasons they chose that location. So that's the kind of 360 on the grounds. But in all of the footage that we reviewed and in the eyewitness statements that we gathered as well from that day, everybody could mention and remembered hearing the sound of Israeli drones, surveillance drones, overhead. That sound really has not left southern Lebanon over the past 2 months almost. There have been brief respites, but the residents of southern Lebanon are very, very accustomed to hearing that sound, to hearing the sound of surveillance drones above. And so what that tells us is, again, you know, Israel had such a clear view of the journalists, either from the air or from the different surveillance points that they have along the border. And, you know, Merkava tanks as well have a very long distance at which they can see quite clearly through the scope. I believe it's up to 9 kilometers, if I'm not mistaken. But either way, those journalists were about 1.3 kilometers from the border. They were clearly within the visible range that you could have from that scope.
They had such a view of the area in three directions. I mean, this is a controversial question. Do you think Israel did not want them there? And what have they said? I mean, right afterwards, when there was tremendous outcry, they said they would look into it. They said they were sorry it happened. They didn't take responsibility. What about now that the Reuters report is out, the Amnesty report is out, the Agence France-Presse report is out?
We, at various points, Reuters, from the very first moment, you know, from that night of Friday, October 13th, sought more details and more information from the Israeli military. So at various points, Reuters has gone back to the Israeli military and asked them, can you give us more information about what happened on that day? Can you tell us whether it was you that targeted them? If so, what were they suspected of doing, or what was the reasoning? And we've gotten very little information. I mean, the IDF has told us, just in response to our findings, that they do not target journalists. And we have gotten nowhere else beyond that. I mean, they have repeatedly said, obviously, when it comes to southern Lebanon, that this is a conflict area, that there's kind of crossfire happening all the time, that's very dangerous. But I think it's really important to remember, again, that these journalists were not embedded with any armed actors. They were there on that hilltop, very, very far away, as Amnesty has really kind of meticulously laid out in its report as well. And as the eyewitnesses told us, very far away from any armed activities and from any crossfire. It's not like they were caught up between two sides shooting at each other. It was a very quiet day, and they were filming shelling at a distance. And it's important to note here as well that after our investigation was published, Reuters editor-in-chief Alessandra Galloni has escalated her calls to Israel, not just to carry out an investigation, but to carry out a criminal investigation, and to determine who exactly was responsible for those two strikes. And you know, that really goes to show that there's something criminal that took place on that day.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 63 journalists and media workers have been killed since October 7th, including 56 Palestinian, 4 Israeli, and 3 Lebanese journalists. Authorities in Gaza put the death toll higher, saying 86 Palestinian media workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th, the Hamas attack. The Committee to Protect Journalists says no other war has taken so many journalists' lives in such a short time span. This, according to CPJ data that's been gathered since 1992. Your final comments, and as we wrap up, Maya, you didn't just do an investigation of people you didn't know. You knew Issam Abdallah well. This is a close-knit community, and it goes beyond Reuters. Journalists dealing with this all over the world, how many journalists are dying right now in Gaza and southern Lebanon. What do you want us to remember about Issam?
Issam was someone who did everything with a lot of passion and integrity. And as we were carrying out this investigation, you know, I was trying to do it in the same way, just to carry, you know, to leave no stone unturned, to do this as right as we possibly could and go as far as we possibly can with that investigation. And even journalists within Reuters who never met Issam were so moved by learning about him as they worked on this investigation, and the way that he did his job, the care with which he approached every interview subject. He treated everybody with so much humanity and with so much love. He was really a model for us in the Beirut Bureau, for people who had been journalists even for longer than him, and for people who were just starting out. He just took the time to teach everyone, to teach our interns, to teach everybody who was in the office how to look for a story, how to do a story justice. And I think that's something that, you know, we're all trying to carry that with us every single day as we try to pick up the pieces in the office and keep covering what is continuing to be, you know, a very active and bloody conflict around the region.
I encourage people to go to our interview with Lema Al-Alrian, who is a dear friend of Issam in Lebanon. She works with Vice News. Maya Jebeli, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Reuters bureau chief for Lebanon, co-wrote the new Reuters special report, Israeli tank fire killed Reuters journalist Issam Abdallah in Lebanon. Coming up, investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept on what he describes as the joint U.S.-Israel military operation in Gaza. And then we'll speak with one of the three Palestinian students, this one who attends Haverford College, and talk about what's happening on campus and that night, Thanksgiving, when he and his two dear friends from Ramallah were shot in Vermont. Stay with us.
أشرف قوم ننسى هالزمان ونحلم زمن ألطف ما زالك بلا شيء ما فيك تخسر شيء
وانا مليت من عشرة نفسي.